Hi, welcome back or welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm Michael Gervais. And the idea behind these conversations is to learn from people who are on the path of mastery, to understand what they're searching for, to understand their strategies, the practices, the ways that they understand the world, their unique psychological framework, if you will, so that we can better understand maybe ways that we can incorporate some of those insights and practices in our own lives. And we certainly want to pay attention to the mental skills that they've used to build and refine their craft. Now, this conversation will be different, and the format is the same. But what's different is that this conversation is with a gentleman who is clearly right center at the home of the way I like to see the world. He's off access, meaning that he does it just a little bit differently, and he does it his way, and he's found a path towards authenticity and insight. And so this conversation might strike you, and it challenged me at the center, and I hope it does you as well. And it definitely, you know, got some juices rolling for creativity and just to really to look within to better understand and to be honest to the truth of the way that we're generating our life efforts and what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. And I have so much more room to grow, and I have so much room to do better, to be a better man, to be a better performer at what I do, that this conversation was a gem. You might not have known his name, and that's all about what this conversation or these conversations on the Finding Mastery podcast are about. It is easy to pay attention to the Leonardo da Vinci's because they're phenomenal and the world knows their name. And also learning from those that are on the path that have similar insights, just maybe not as well refined or polished is a better word for the global performances that they've gained recognition for. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Facet. When we think about what it takes to thrive and to live a life of flourishing, there's no doubt that financial wellness is a big part of that equation. There's lots of ways to manage your money. And here's one that you might be interested in. Facet is the next generation of personalized financial planning. They're on a mission to make expert financial advice accessible to the masses. So Facet provides you with flexible access to a team of financial planners and a team of experts across retirement planning, tax strategy, estate planning, and more. And the best part here is that instead of taking a percentage of your portfolio, Facet only charges an affordable flat membership fee and doesn't charge you to invest with them. This is extremely rare for the industry. As you probably know, most financial advisors charge you a percentage of your assets. And even if it's only 1%, those fees can really add up over the course of your lifetime. And because you're listening to this podcast, Facet is hooking you up with a great offer. When you sign up today, Facet will waive the $250 enrollment fee for new annual members. And they have an epic limited time offer on top of that. To learn more, just head to facet.com/FM. Again, this one is a little different. That's Facet, facet.com/FM to waive your enrollment fee and to learn more about their limited time offer. A little disclosure here. Facet Wealth Inc., Facet, is an SEC registered investment advisor headquartered in Baltimore, Maryland. This is not an offer to sell securities or investment, financial, legal, or tax advice. Past performance is not a guarantee of future performance. Terms and conditions apply. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Bubs Naturals. Like you, I am mindful about what I put into my body. So for me, it usually comes down to ingredients and simplicity. The shorter the list, the better. And that's why I've been loving Bubs Naturals. Bubs creates products with high quality, all natural ingredients that are designed to help us get after the adventures in life. For years, I've been a huge fan of their Hydrate or Die electrolyte mix. I mean, that's a fun title for a product, isn't it? It only has 6 total ingredients. It's packed with electrolytes. I love the taste. No added sugar, no artificial flavors, none of that stuff. It's great for post-workout recovery. That's when I use it. And I also use it during long periods of travel, which I've been doing a lot lately. And so thank you for the hydration here. And a ton of athletes that I know swear by them too. They're currently in just about every MLB locker room. They work closely with the Red Sox, the Yankees, I know the Rangers, Cardinals, Diamondbacks, and many more, of course. I'd love for you to go check them out. I think they're doing a really nice job. Just head to bubsnaturals.com/findingmastery and enter the code findingmastery at checkout for 20% off your first purchase. Again, that's Bubs Naturals, BUBS naturals.com/findingmastery with a code findingmastery for 20% off your first purchase. So this conversation, let's jump right into it with Karen Bajaj. Now, Karen, one of the notable things that he's been able to accomplish, he was top 40 under 40 marketers in the US by Ad Age's. And so that's phenomenal. That was back in 2007. He's worked at Procter & Gamble. He's, you know, had executive roles for some of the big firms. But what's fascinating is he's also written a lot. And he's one of the, he's the number one best-selling Indian novelist with more than 200,000 copies sold. And both of his books, or both of his novels that are in print have been optioned for major films. Okay, so he's on to something. Many people have found what he's on to be interesting. And I'm not sure that the audience that we are amassing together will be new to his, I think that will be a new conversation for many people listening today. Okay, so here's the essence, is that he's got this model where he works for 4 years and then takes a year off, a complete year off. And that 4 years where he's grinding at work is not so he can just take a breath for a year, but he goes and searches, and he searches within himself, and he just travels to better understand insight and truth and wisdom and how he can apply it in his life. Okay, I hope this scares you a little bit. I really hope this conversation scares you just a little bit. It did for me. With that, see if there's one thing that you can take from this conversation, just one, that you might apply or do better in your own life. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Hit us up on social media at Michael Gervais on Twitter. And then for Instagram, it's at Finding Mastery. If you're new to this conversation, these podcasts, punch over to findingmastery.net/community and see if you find those conversations on the community page of interest. I think you might. All right. All the best. Thank you for the support. If you haven't written a review and this conversation maybe is the prompt to do so, please go over to iTunes and write us a quick little review. It's gratefully helpful. And I hope you have a fantastic day, evening, week, whatever it might be for you. All the best. Let's jump right into this conversation with Karen. All right, Karen, welcome to the Finding Mastery podcast. I'm excited to have this conversation with you.
Yeah, same here, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. All right. Beautiful. So there's, you've obviously come to understand quite a bit about your journeys and through your writings. And I want to be able to celebrate the new book and the previous books that you've written. And I want to be able to have a conversation with you about sabbaticals and how you have explored life and the structure that you've created to be able to do so. And so I'm hopefully that we'll be able to, you know, find a blend between both of those. But that idea that you figured out how to extricate yourself from the hustle and bustle and to be able to create space to be able to get connected to the signal, I love it. And so before we get into the nuances of that, can you bring us into like the fold of what it was like when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. So I grew up in the foothills of the Himalayas in India, in a small, or at least at that time, a small town called Shimla. And like it was very secluded little town for almost for the first 14, 15 years of my life. And then I got into high school in Delhi and then like, you know, just did my schooling in India and got a chance to move out of the country and then like took various corporate jobs in Philippines, Singapore, Europe, and then the US.
Mm-hmm. And then yeah. What was it like? So, you know, I've never been to the Himalayas. They're fascinating and majestic to think about or to view. And then also, you know, amazing to think about the explorers of that range. So what was it like growing up there?
It was a combination of two things. I think the it was very idyllic in the way you would think of, like of a lot of space in your life with not too much pressure, playing in the mountainside, rivers, and very strange things that didn't seem strange at that time, but now in retrospect appear, or not now also they don't appear strange, but there was a period in time when I went out of the Himalayas and I came to the real world and they appeared very strange, like the yogis who lived in the caves near our village. And they were like very conventional people, like doctors, lawyers, engineers who had left their lives behind and stayed in caves and ashrams near our village. So stuff like that was, so there's a lot of interesting kind of things that, you know, that became kind of wallpaper when we were growing up, but in retrospect were very interesting. And so that was the good part, I think. And the flip side of the whole experience, I think, is that if you're naturally ambitious, then it's a very hard place to escape from, because like, for instance, my school until 10th grade, until I left for New Delhi, we didn't study geometry at all, because like the teacher didn't forget, like I never taught the second mathematics book. So like I was very behind when I kind of came into the main world. So I think the flip side of that was that it took a lot of effort to kind of like, you know, to spread my wings after growing up there.
And is it because the community didn't want you to spread your wings, or it was just that, you know, why would you leave this majestic place?
It's something like that. I think it was the latter more than anything else. Like I think people's whole life revolved around that place, and like, you know, in a sense on paper you have everything, right? Like the land is very rich, so you know, so like you have like I guess sufficient, not rich, but in the sense of you have sufficient money to live on, and there is a very strong sense of community. So it's in a sense like you don't have if it's in the Maslow's hierarchy, you have everything. You have money, you have social esteem, you have everything that you need to live a life of contemplation. So there didn't seem any need to like break out of that. So there was never any like thrust to, you know, to kind of break out. Yeah.
Mm, okay. And so what is the family system like? Is it different than, you know, a Western approach, or, you know, does it have more of a community feel to it?
It's very community feel, and it's dramatically different, because I think sometimes words like community versus individualism get very, I guess, misused, and like we saw, but I like to give you a more practical example. Like my wife is American right now, so she grew up Irish Catholic in New Jersey. So I'm kind of seeing two different lives, if you will. So if you think of an Irish Catholic family, on the surface, that also has a very rich sense of community, right? Because she has 40 cousins, all of which are in the New Jersey area, Connecticut area. They're all live very near to us. But I think what happens in a place like India is that there is no demand on personal privacy of any kind. Like there is no concept of a person almost. So even if you have, when I compare it to the community that I see in the US, even when people grow up in rich communities, there is a lot of demand for individual growth, individual ambition, privacy. And I think it comes from many factors. Some of it are very physical. Like in India, we are very densely packed. Even in my village or in my town, we were very densely packed. Like 6 or 8 people would live in the same space that 1 or 2 people would live here, you know, like, you know, I grew up with one sibling in the same room. Like we were living in a very small square foot house, which is the kind of the normal way of being for most people. And as a result, you have no concept of a personal boundary at all. And so I think your life kind of completely merges into the community. And that has a tremendous amount of implications on so many levels. Like when I think of the fact that I never knew that I could be a writer until I came to the US, that's a very, like, that you can just think that for the first 28 years of my life, I didn't even know that I could write, because I never had the space in my life to be to kind of explore that dimension at all. And I think when I came to the US, you actually have a lot more space, time to explore facets of yourself, because I think this culture values individual achievement and individual, I guess, like, you know, the individual thrust to fully explore their potential in a way that I don't think we ever valued in India, when I was growing up. So there's so many dimensions to that whole concept of personal boundaries, personal space, personal exploration, that even in a very high community environment in the US, you can never even conceptualize that. In India, it means completely losing yourself to the community.
Is that because of a spiritual
framework, or is it more of a resource framework that there's, you know, a lack of resources, so we fit as many people in to a bedroom as we can? Or is it more like, listen, we don't need to make a large footprint, and this is about our family, and of course we love each other, and we're gonna, you know, we're gonna spend time together, so we don't need four bedrooms for two kids?
It's a little bit of both, obviously. Like, obviously, in the metropolitans like Delhi and stuff, it's very much about a physical constraint and, like, you know, like the fact that the space is very dense. In places like up in the mountains, I think it's a little hard. Like, if I almost think of it, like, in Indian scriptures, there's this idea that kind of life is like the flight of an eagle, in which you spread your wings high. In the beginning, like, you kind of push the boundaries of experience to the extent you can. You have as many experiences as you can to truly grow and become a person in its fullest form. And then you kind of bring the wings down and become silent and contemplative and lose your sense of self, almost like that idea of individual expression. And I feel like a lot of, like, where I was growing up, at least, was very much like that. There were people who had consciously chosen to live in that community because they had reached that point in which they were kind of bringing their wings down, if you will, and like losing this idea of India. Like, it was a very deliberate choice to lose their idea of individual expression or individual potential, chasing individual potential.
And so if they're not chasing individual potential, which seems to be such a mark for how we speak and how I speak about life efforts, you know, from a Western frame, is...
Yeah.
And it's not meant to be, I want to get to the question, but first, like, a preamble, is that it's not meant to be a selfish pursuit, but it's meant to almost be a requirement to be able to figure out how you can best be you so that you can be there better for others.
Yeah.
And if you can't be there for yourself because you of self-monitoring or fear or... whatever other survival strategies that are deep in our coding, that we're not able to ever even get close to being able to help, support, challenge, and authentically be there for others. So the pivot for me is like, and this is only because of who I've studied from and the influences I've had, is first get yourself right. And it's almost like a duty to do so, to be able to give to others. And then, so the question is, if the pursuit is not personal and individualistic, what is the main pursuit for the small town in the Himalayas that you grew up in?
There is this idea in Sanskrit, there's a word called dharma. I don't know if you've ever heard of this word, but it's a beautiful concept. The concept of dharma is that every being has an innate tendency. So the innate tendency or the innate dharma of a tree is to grow and bear fruit. It's not to dress up and go to office. Like, that's the tree exists to grow and bear fruit. In the same way, water exists to quench thirst and the ice melts. Like, that's just the dharma of these beings. And in the same way, like, as you get into animal to man, we each have a, through whether you believe it in lifetimes or whatever, you have a certain thrust, a certain innate tendency. And I think in this purest form, when I think of the people there, they were living, their whole goal was to purify themselves to an extent that their dharma showed. So there was this idea of becoming wasn't that strong, which I think is a very, I guess, innate part of being in the US, or like at least in this part of the world, there is this idea that you're always becoming, like you always want to become and grow and become better and move from a lawyer to become a life purpose coach or whatever. Like, you know, there's always this idea that you have to go through radical reinvention and become someone. And I think in a form, I feel like the idea there was that it's rather than become, you purify yourself so that your most innate tendency expresses itself. And in this act of purification, you'll keep growing so that the tendency keeps changing. And the whole idea of becoming is more organic than dramatic, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, organic. So it's a, when you say organic, do you mean that it's like a reveal?
It's a reveal, exactly. That's a very good way to put it. It's a reveal, almost like a, like, you know, like when you meet a priest in a temple there, sometimes you like just feel that this person is like just meant to be a priest. Like, he loves the scripture. He loves to recite the scripture in Sanskrit or whatever. He loves the language of Sanskrit. And then what you see over a period of time is that as these guys tend to purify themselves more and more, their tendencies start to change. So then they become teachers, and then they get a school, and then the school expands. So they're almost like, while what the same equivalent of that in the US would be a person being like, okay, now I'm a lawyer, now I'm going to become a teacher who's going to teach hundreds of people. Like, there's a very dramatic conscious act of becoming, which I think exposes a lot of insecurities and this and that and fear. I think all of those things come because you are making these very radical inventions, which I'm not against. I think they have some role to do that. But I think there, the whole process, you don't have those many cultural conversations, I guess, about fear and like gratitude and feeling blessed and all that. Like, people just are living, I guess, in its... And then slowly their lives keeps changing because their life keeps getting more and more purified because they're acting in accordance with that dharma.
Okay. And did you say dharma?
Dharma, yeah. D-H-A-R-M-A. It's a beautiful concept because it's a very complex and interesting word on... Because I think the question to I ask is what... Like, because right now with the novel coming out and... You know, success with my early novels in terms of movie deals and stuff. There's a lot of like questions that come on, or people ask me on why don't I quit my job and become a full-time writer since it's becoming financially lucrative. And it's very hard to explain that it's just not my dharma. Like, I'm good at business. It's my dharma to be in the corporate world. And like, I have other passions that I'm exploring and getting better and deep at. And maybe one day it will happen on its own. But right now, I don't feel like making those big thrusts because my dharma is not changed yet, you know?
So dharma is a powerful phrase and word and understanding and way of being and to reveal oneself. Okay. What are the practices that you have come to learn to help people reveal and to find the organic way of being so that they can... bring fruit to that into the world and to others around them? What are some of the practices that you found to be valuable?
So there are some everyday practices which are pretty common, obviously meditation and all, which you have already talked at length. But I think for me, what's helped me tremendously is that this 414 kind of model that I talk a little bit about, in which I work for 4 years and then take a year off. But it's not about working for 4 years and then taking a year off to write. It's really about 4 years of very conscious goal-driven activity in which I'm kind of operating in this very Western way, if I will, I write with a lot of discipline after my job. I come back, I'm writing 3 days a week for 1.5 hours. On the weekends, I'm writing 4 hours. I'm extraordinarily disciplined in this 4 year period in both my job and my writing and my, I guess, acquisition of knowledge in the world. But then in the year that I take off, I'm very consciously goalless, completely strip myself of all idea of becoming. So in that year, I make both physical and emotional decisions in line with that. So for instance, in the last sabbatical, my wife went from Europe to India by road with a very clear intention that we won't plan a single day at all. Like, we'll really just make decisions which are completely intuitive and natural and come from within, if you will. But that's at a physical level. But even at an emotional level, I don't read at all, or not at all, but I don't take a Kindle or whatever. I'm consciously kind of cutting off this emotional noise and emotional materialism almost that seeps in which you really constantly want to become someone better by reading morning rituals and this and that. And I'm just kind of consciously trying to just loosen and truly be. So there would be months when I was like learning yoga and meditation in the Himalayas that I didn't write even a word, and then I wrote in bursts in my time in Portugal. And I kind of have done this a couple of times, three times now, and I felt that for me, this tightening in which I'm able to be productive and get things done, and this complete loosening allows me the space to, I've done enough to have explored different ideas because I've been reading a lot, but then I have this year in which I'm completely just free. And in that freedom, I think things come to me, and I think that's how I guess innate tendencies start to reveal themselves, if you will, you know.
Golly. I mean, I hear you talk about it and I think to myself, how wonderful that would be And I know it's a choice, but at the same time, I think to myself, like, how could I possibly do it? And so when I heard this concept that you're actually doing it and you're finding, experiences both on the goal-driven part and the goal-less part to be equally rewarding and balance each other out, like, it's fascinating. So what allowed you I want to learn about how you explored this as an option before we get into like how you made the decision to go for it. But what led you to explore this as an option? Were you just flat out burnt out? Were you listening to inspired texts and readings and listening to yourself and saying, I need time away or time within? What is it that led you to want to do this?
Actually, Michael, it started at a very basic level, which was I'd been working for 5-6 years with Procter & Gamble, 5 years or something. I was doing pretty well and stuff. And then I actually credit being in the US for the first time, I think. As I went from my village in India to Delhi, the whole idea was to become successful in the world, if you will, right? So I went to engineering college, business school, started my corporate career, and was very linearly focused on doing well in my career. And I think coming to the US, suddenly having a lot more time and space in my life, also starting to see people living slightly divergent lives around me, I think, for the first time, rather than a mass of homogeneity, only because you have such a strong network of friends and family in India and stuff, that you almost kind of like your whole world becomes restricted to them. And I think for the first time, being completely out of my life and living in a new world just exposed me to new things. So I just decided to travel. I just quit my job, or I actually asked for a sabbatical and decided to travel. And like my idea was to just live in places that I'd always had fantasies of living in, like Mongolia for 3 months and Bhutan for a month, like places that I'd always like envisioned that I would live in one day. And then what happened to me was that I started to write at the end of 6 months of like living in these places. And I wrote like a book in when I was living in Brazil and stuff. And I was just stunned at the end of it that it turned into a proper novel, which got released, did well. I think I was surprised by the fact that I didn't even know that I had this ability in me to write a complete novel that could be read by people and impact people. And then I was like, okay, so I didn't even know I was capable of that. So what else am I, capable of? So then I started to kind of systemize this idea that I have to take a year to not become, like, so instance, in the next sabbatical, I'm not going with the goal that I want to become a better writer. Like, I'm going with this goal that I'm going to take a year to do some things with my children, like live in an orphanage in Cambodia with my children for 4 months Spain and learn Spanish with my kids for 4 years. So I'm just going with this idea, and then let's see what happens, you know, like nothing. So I just like this idea of like becoming finding out things about myself that I didn't even know existed, rather than being like, okay, I'm going to take a sabbatical to now write better after working better. Like it's not a sabbatical to become anyone better or different or whatever, you know, it's just to let be.
Finding Mastery is brought to you by UCAN. One important way to take control of your metabolic fitness is to fuel with foods that help regulate your blood sugar. It's key for your metabolism to work effectively and to maintain sustainable energy levels. So many sports drinks and energy products are filled with sugar or fast digesting carbs. And while those give you a quick flash of energy, it ends up being short-lived and can lead to a crash. UCAN has taken a different approach, and that's why they're loved by so many elite athletes that I know. Their products deliver a sustained release of long-lasting energy that helps you maintain sharper focus, curb hunger cravings, to help you exercise harder without spiking blood sugar. They've developed a patent low-glycemic carbohydrate called Live Steady. It's derived from a complex starch instead of sugar, and its efficacy is backed by extensive research and clinical trials, which I know you love. A few members of the team here at Finding Mastery use UCAN on a regular basis while preparing for marathons and other endurance events, and they've loved it too. They say it's a game changer in their training and performance. Whether you're an intense exerciser or recreationally active or just looking for an energy boost to get you through the day, I hope that you'll consider checking out UCAN as a smarter way to fuel. You can try a variety of UCAN products for free when you head to ucan.co/findingmastery. You just pay for shipping. They'll cover the rest. Again, that's UCAN, spelt UCAN.co/findingmastery to try a selection of UCAN products for free. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Apollo Neuro. I am really excited about what Apollo Neuro is building. If you haven't had the chance yet, I highly recommend that you go check out the conversation I had with their co-founder, Dr. David Rabin, on the podcast. It is well worth a listen. Unlike traditional wearables that simply track your biometrics, Apollo is doing it totally differently. Apollo Neuro is designed to actively improve your health by enhancing sleep, relaxation, energy, and focus. So how's it work? Developed by neuroscientists and physicians, Apollo delivers these soothing little vibrations. They call them Apollo vibes, that are like music your body can feel. More rapid vibrations help to improve your energy and focus, while the slower vibrations help to promote rest and digest in your body. And the best part for me, they're grounded in good science. Apollo has been tested by thousands of users in clinical and real-world trials. I would love for you to give it a go. It's making a meaningful difference in my life. And because you're listening to this podcast, you can receive an exclusive 15% off an Apollo wearable. Just head to apolloneuro.com/findingmastery and use the code findingmastery at checkout. This is an exclusive offer. It's only for us here at Finding Mastery. So be sure to use the code at checkout. Again, that's Apollo, APOLLO, Apollo Neuro, NEURO, apolloneuro.com/findingmastery, or use the code findingmastery at checkout for 15% off your purchase.
And how old are your kids during these phases?
I've never done a sabbatical with them, so it'll be very interesting right now. They're like very young, 2 years and 6 months. So by the time we do our next sabbatical, they'll be four. And so I'm in my 4 year cycle, right? So in 2 more years, they'll be about, or 18 months more, they'll be about four and two.
Jeez.
So, yes.
Yeah. So I've got some friends that have a very similar approach. Like one of my friends who's world class at what he does, he and his wife are not going to put their child in formal education, and they're not going to homeschool, and they're just going to go for a vagabond experience. And, okay. And they've got this logic around, you know what, we travel the world, we do it for a sport, we're going to teach them, and we're going to teach them through smells and sounds and conversations, and we're not going to do formal education because that's becoming archaic. I'm like, wow, you know, that's it's really bold. And yeah, they're going for it. And I hear you doing something in a similar vein. And yeah, I want to tell you a quick story. I think you'll appreciate it. Is that I remember the first time, it was surfing, where I was out in the water and there was only like two or three other people in the water. And it felt like I was alone. And it felt like I was the most west a person could be. And remember, I'm like a kid. You're like, you know, and I look west into the horizon on the west coast of California, and I can't see anyone. So I'm like, I'm the most west a person could be. And I remember that space that was created from that thought and that experience. Uh-huh. And similar to, I think, how you came when you came to the States. And I remember thinking as a young kid, like, if I wanted to curse right now, I could. If I want, like, that was me breaking the rules, right? Saying a bad word. Yeah. And that being said, so that's how I'm relating to what it felt like for you to come to the States. And I think that most people would say that, oh my gosh, I don't feel like the current Western way of living has any space. I'm bombarded by external noise. I'm bombarded by internal stress. And I feel like the only time I get space is in the bathroom, and I'm compelled to, you know, look at my cell phone while I'm in the bathroom as well. So can you talk a little bit more about how you see the Western or the States, the United States, having space?
Yeah, I think that's why I feel for the West, I really like this 414 kind of an approach, because what I've seen here is that when people try to create space here, they end up creating a they think they're creating space, but they end up creating a different kind of problem or a different kind of busyness for themselves. So what happens is that they are a lawyer and then they want to become a life purpose coach, right? So you're replacing one level of busyness with a completely another level of chaotic busyness, while what they're really craving is a little bit of like nothingness in between, with no pressure to become someone different and create a reinvention, another reinvention. So I think that's why when you take a free fall, knowing that it's not a complete free fall because you're having a great net of coming back towards what you left behind, I think you just become more, that's when you truly create space. So like, because now, like when I take a year off, I'm not trying to monetize that year. I'm not trying to write a blog about my experiences in Spain, which can lead to a movie deal. Like there's no pressure to do all of that, right? There's a true space that's created as a result. Because I know I'll come back to my career. And maybe I don't, but at least that's my going in assumption, is that I'm taking a year of space and not a year of like changing to a different life again.
Has your firm and your company and the stability of that job allowed you the footing to be able to take the year off?
And it's not been an easy conversation everywhere. But having said that, I also think, like, I've done it with three different companies now: Procter & Gamble, Boston Consulting Group, and Kraft Foods. And none of them are like the Googles of the world, which you would think of, like, you know, where everybody's like taking sabbaticals and going, like, you know, doing mindfulness retreats. Like, these are as conventional Midwestern companies as you can get, like P&G and Kraft. The surprising thing, honestly, is that nobody's asking for them. So it's not like you're competing with a pool of people who are wanting to take year offs. Because I think what I've realized here is that that the corporate track and the hippie track are quite separate from each other. It's almost like the corporate people are just very linear and working in their jobs forever and building and buying houses. And like, you know, it's a very conventional track. And then the hippies are totally off the corporate world. There are not too many people who are working in both spaces, but that's one. And I think the other thing is that I don't think people have those kind of governing passions that kind of propel them in this direction. Like I really had this passion to write in my second sabbatical. I really wanted to learn yoga and meditation as a teacher, like become very deeply ingrained in the practice in the next sabbatical. So I had these anchor things that I wanted to construct a year around, even if it didn't fill the whole year. And I think once again, I've not seen people have that. So not too many people are asking for them. If you have these anchors, you have a lot of firmness and conviction when you ask. So like, I remember when I first asked for a sabbatical in P&G, they said, can you take a month instead of a year? And then we went back and forth about it. And then like, I was very convinced that I would do it. And then like the organization kind of rallies behind you. And then also what happens is, if you're in like my kind of mindset right now, I know that I'm going to be a disruption to any organization, because 4 years into the job, I'll be knocking at the door and saying, a time to go. You'll have to either, I'm going to leave, quit the job, or take an unpaid sabbatical, and my role has to be filled by someone, and it's a disruption. So I know that I have to be exceptional in the years that I'm working. So I think that kind of like mentality is very, like right now, I know 18 months later, I'm being very open about it also. I'm just like, I have it on my blog, like in 18 months, I am going to ask my job and say I'm going to leave, or but that makes me very conscientious in the years that I'm working to be that exceptional person who is allowed these exceptional change things. So I think those kind of things kind of like work well with each other. For me, what happens as a result also is that my act of creation is very pure. Like if you look at my blog or like my novels, they're truly exploring what I'm learning, and I'm not trying to monetize them or become something through them. As a result, I think I just feel like I'm very in a good groove in terms of that I can really explore myself through what I'm creating and really not have the burden to monetize it.
And what do you think the benefit is of if somebody was to take this course? What would you imagine is the most apparent benefit? And maybe that's not the right question, but I'm trying to, you know, run through, like, I feel a calling and a wanting to do this.
Yeah.
And I've said this ever since my wife and I were really young, is that I want to chase winter and chase summer. And I want to do that. You know, that's what I want to go ski in the most intense places. And I want to chase summer for the greatest surf. And so I have a lot of reasons why I'm not doing that. And if I'm not careful, I'll never do it. And one of the reasons right now is like the duty that I have to provide for my family. And I hear the trap in that, especially heightened when I'm having a conversation with you about it. But I hear the trap, and I also hear that this fear that, well, I've come to understand some stuff, and like I should strike while the iron's hot. And if I don't strike, things might cool off, and I might completely miss, you know, the right temperature to create, you know, a beautiful sword, meaning from iron to sword.
Yeah.
So, what, you know, how do you help? Those are all the options. And how can you help me? I don't think I'm that different from many people. Like, how can you help going through this decision-making process? And as I'm having this conversation with you, I'm feeling my heart rate stimulate. You know, like, okay, yeah.
So I'm actually going to start. I'll give you the first question you asked has a lot of intangibles to it. And intangibles are sometimes harder to create decisions around. But I'll give you those. But I'll start with the...
Wait, you know what? I'm almost nervous. I'm like almost really... Like I am nervous about what you're going to say to me is going to alter like what I'm going to do for the next, you know, maybe 4 years of my life. So I'm not even sure that I want you to go any further. Oh my God. Okay.
But I want to give you a tangible benefit first, because I think that just might push over the edge. So I'm going to give it to you. I've never tried to make money from my sabbaticals. I've always planned that in the 4 years that I'm working, I'll accumulate money to some extent. And then in the year off, I'm going to spend it I have some principles we also live in willful poverty and all that kind of stuff. Like we don't we'll try to go Europe to India by road, live in the ashram in the Himalayas. It's very conscious that not just to save money, but to kind of strip our life of comfort is very important for a period of time, so that I guess we become closer to what matters and not construct our life around comfort again, all that kind of stuff. But the point being, I've always believed that in the year I'll end up spending money, and I do. And here is the truth about it. All 3 years that I've been off have been extraordinarily profitable. And I'll tell you, and it's not in a one-for-one way, but in the last year that I took off, I spent the grand total of the two of us together spent about $26,000, $13,000 per person, because honestly, living in Portugal in a village is a beautiful experience, but it is $450 for like a kind of a villa, you know, and then living in Goa in India and like Himalayas, you're like, you can't spend money even if you like are committed to doing that. So between the two of us, we spent $25,000. I wrote in Portugal and a little bit in the Himalayas in like some kind of a very transcendental way. And then when I came back, the book deal from Random House was a little low six figures, you know? And so if I think of the profitability of that sabbatical, it is very high. Not that I intended it to be. And that's happened three times to an extent that I kind of a little bit attributed to luck. But the other, like a part of me is now kind of attributing it to this pattern that if you're growing dramatically as a person in a intuitive, emotional sense, because that's what happens to me, is that I'm growing, I become less rational and become more intuitive, because my natural course of being is very left-brained, analytical, rational. And here I'm truly learning to become intuitive in my decision-making, in my writing, in everything. If you're growing in that dimension emotionally, you will be, in some form or the other, that will manifest in better work in the world. And that will have some kind of a material benefit to it. So I can't just justify that three times in a row, in some form or the other, either I've gotten a bigger book deal or a faster promotion at my work than I expected. I expect to lose my, I guess, position in the company, but I come back and get promoted almost ahead of people who've actually been working that year. That it almost makes me feel that there is a material reward which accompanies it because of the emotional growth that's happening in your person. But that's kind of the more truly the material part that I do, tangible return of doing a sabbatical for me. And then there's so many intangibles that, you know, I learned to be much more intuitive because I'm making decisions, consciously making decisions out of intuition. Then I learned this idea of this whole silence is very good, because the year of not reading too much and not being bombarded by this email ritual is great for you, and this magic morning is wonderful for you, and you know, this is how much you should meditate. Like, there's so much noise of people wanting to tell me how to become better at who. So it's very good for me to just operate with this idea that I have everything I need to create, within me and not outside me. And that leads to very pure, good creations, I think. So I think all those benefits are very intangible, but very real.
Okay. Yeah, I hear you. And yes. Jeez. What do you do? I want to understand one more layer deeper, I think, for me, is I've had this idea that if you get to the mountaintop and you can find some spiritual reprise and you can be present and mindful and practice mindfulness even there with all the, you know, the lack of noise, but more of a harmony, that's wonderful. And then when you come down the goat trail, you know, are you nervous and rushing and anxious and frustrated or, you know, whatever. And then you've missed the point of the mountaintop, so to speak. And then at some part in the journey, it becomes wildly apparent that the goal is to take the mountaintop into the city.
Yeah.
And then be that more often. Okay.
Yeah.
And then it became, I guess I should say, apparent that it's not just about being in the city, but it's about pushing capacity and being present in capacity building moments, which are hard to do. And so that's like an infusion for me. It's like taking the yin and the yang and the infusion between science and application and craft and progression as opposed to trust and being. And all of that being said, you've got a relatively different model. It's like 4 years head down, 1 year of almost replenishing. And it's the 4 years of becoming and goals and the 1 year of being and intuitive observation. And so there's somewhat different models. And I'm wondering if you could just speak to what you see that I might be missing, or I just wonder if you could just riff off of what I just said.
No, it's great. I think there are two different thoughts. One, you're absolutely correct. My model is a little bit based on that you fill the gas tank and then slowly the world depletes the gas tank and then you fill it up again. So it's a little bit of a replenishment and exhaustion model, because I do know that living in the city, publishing my books, marketing them, working my job, like the ecosystem that I'm surrounded with, will have a depletion effect, you know, just because I'm in the world and I need to replenish it. But the more subtle point is it'll be a little funny to hear, but I do think it's important, is that in India, growing up in India and being very exposed to, in some form or the other, Hinduism, Buddhism, it's very viscerally this idea of karma, cause and effect, and a series of lifetimes starts to sink into your being. So I think what happens to me as a result is that I'm not trying to reach perfection in this life, almost. So I think your burden is very high. Your standards are very high, right? You want to go to this mountaintop. You want to become very silent and peaceful, and you want to be completely silent and peaceful when you come back. While I have a feeling that I'm on this gradual road of purification, and I won't reach the end goal in this life, and that's very comfortable for me in a way that it's hard to explain if you don't viscerally believe in this idea that there are many lifetimes for you to kind of like, you know, go through the cycle of cause and effect and further purification. So I think the burden for me to become perfect is not very immediate. So I feel with every sabbatical, I'm getting purified. I come back into the world, I get depleted again, but I'm still 10% or like a little bit more purified in my actions than I was before. And then the next time I'll be even more purified in my actions, and then I'll be even more purified. And maybe at the end of this life, I'll reach some level of purity that will be further propelled in the next life. I guess it's just a little more comfortable for me, this idea that I won't reach perfection.
Yeah. And I mean, no, it's good.
Yeah. And
very, dogmatic from a Hindu perspective, right?
It is dogmatic, but it's also just like the fact is that it's not dogma in terms of a belief, almost that it's hard to say that, but it's almost a very rational kind of ecosystem in which the cause and effect cycle keeps you do see in a very real way that if your actions are pure, the effects are purer. That's a cause effect cycle that you see. And And like you do understand that that cause effect cycle keeps continuing. So you, I guess you don't see it as a, you just see it as a steady stream of cause and effect rather than a very mystical, like next birth, I'll be like a vegetable or an animal. Like I don't think in those concepts, I just see it as a continuous cause and effect stream of further and further purification.
Okay. Beautiful.
Of my actions. So yeah, but it's so, like when you explain it, it sounds either dogmatic or a belief system, but in my world, it's very viscerally sunk into my being.
Okay, yeah. I think that internalizing, right?
Yeah.
You know, the swallowing, if you will, of ideas or thoughts and where they become really organic as the way that we put lenses back onto the world is really an important process. And how long did it take you to be able to internalize and really create this where it's just a saturation of your psychological framework?
This was a little easier because even though I didn't grow up religious at all, my dad was in the army and in India, it's actually in India, it's surprising. I think our like people like our generation, like my parents' generation, rejected religion in the same way like our millennials or whatever are rejecting it today in the US, because we grew up in such a dogmatic environment with so much casteism and rituals that the modern thinkers, my father who was in the army, my mom who was a school teacher, they made it a point to reject religion. So we actually grew up very absent of religion. But the thing though is that it's a very kind of, it truly is a spiritual country in that way that like you are constantly exposed to this karma, dharma, all these kind of concepts. So I think these were very much a part of our life when we were growing up. So we just accepted them. But later, I think I was very pulled to reading these texts. And then like in Buddhism, I think there's a beautiful idea of Sharana, Manana, Nididhyana as the three stages of learning. Sharana is learning through secondary sources, whether it be book or gurus or whatever. Your next stage of learning is reflection. And then your third stage of learning, where the truth becomes real, is Nididhyana or experience. So you have to go through learning, reflection, and experience. So I think when we grew up, we learned a lot. When I think I kind of like matured and started to read these texts on my own, I started to reflect a lot. And then I think over the last couple of years, I'm truly immersing myself in my practice of meditation. And I think it's become a more experiential reality. So I think I've gone through these three phases, and I've been a little lucky that the learning phase happened very organically because I was just growing up in that environment.
Yeah, there you go. And can you respond to the phrase spiritual materialism? Does that mean anything to you?
Spiritual materialism, in a sense, it means like what I term as emotional materialism in a way, like which is this. I guess constant hunger to become mm-hmm. like to become more spiritual, become better, become more pure, become like the I guess the physical manifestation of that is what you see in the yoga world today. Like when I go to New York yoga studios and stuff, it seems so jarring because like people are wearing these like kurtas and like have these like, you know, these beads, and they're talking the spiritual language of vibrations and energy fields, and you can see that it's a very big disconnect to who they are and want to be. Like they're putting on a garb, like a physical appearance of some sort in the hope that they'll become better as a result, which I appreciate. This idea of becoming better is, I appreciate, but I think in India, you just, I guess the whole process is not very A to B. Like you suddenly don't go and become a spiritual person with a kurta and a mala. You start to explore a little bit of text, start to purify a little, you just accept spirituality where you are and not try to become. I think this spiritual materialism for me is this idea of becoming.
Yeah. And spiritual, the way I think about spiritual materialism is that it's like trying to reinforce one's ego through material things and belief systems and religion and emotional states of mind, where it's like you're trying to infuse a sense of ego based on either beliefs and or things. Yeah. Which is just a terrible trap. And eventually leads to deeper and deeper suffering.
Finding Mastery is brought to you by AquaTrue. We all know how important hydration is to performance and recovery and well-being, but it's not just about how much you drink. The quality of your water plays a big role. And if you're like me and you don't fully trust tap water, And I think for good reason, research by the Environmental Working Group has shown that 3 out of 4 homes in the U.S. have harmful contaminants in tap water. That's why I'm really excited to introduce AquaTrue. Their purifiers use a 4-stage reverse osmosis purification process, and their countertop purifiers remove 15 times more contaminants than ordinary pitcher filters. It's incredible. I can literally taste the difference in my water. Plus, the filters are affordable and long-lasting. Just one set of filters from their classic purifier makes the equivalent of 4,500 bottles of water. That adds up to less than 3 cents per bottle. It feels great to know that all at once, I'm saving money, getting the highest quality water for the Finding Mastery team, and helping make a positive impact on the environment by eliminating single-use plastics all the way around. AquaTrue comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee, and it even makes a great gift. And right now, because you're a Finding Mastery listener, you receive 20% off any AquaTrue purifier. So just go to AquaTrue.com. You spell it AquaTru.com and enter the code Finding Mastery at checkout. Again, that's AquaTrue.com. Enter the Finding Mastery code at checkout to receive 20% off any purifier that you buy there. Finding Mastery is brought to you by Ritual. They are a supplement company. They just care about what they're doing. They are flat out committed. And they've got this idea that Ritual is made traceable, which means that their products are made with a visible supply chain so that you can see exactly what they're doing. Their key ingredients, the supply chain, the research, the whole thing. For companies that are showing you exactly what's on the inside, exactly how they're doing it so that you know and feel comfortable knowing what you're consuming, I think it's a really nice touch. I think it's required. I think they are setting the standard for supplement companies. The product that I'm using right now that I flat out love is their Symbiotic. It's a 3-in-1 gut health supplement that, you know, microbiome is really important. So I need it. I think that you might benefit from it too, but of course I don't know. Go check out what they're doing. And it just gives me this peace of mind knowing that this is a company, this is a brand that doesn't cut corners. If you haven't had the chance to listen to our Finding Mastery episode with Ritual's founder, Katarina Schneider, I really want to encourage you to go check that out. It's episode 428. She's awesome. It's a fascinating conversation where Kat beautifully describes her story and Ritual's mission. They are investing in their company's quality so that you can invest in the quality of your life. So I want to encourage you to head over to ritual.com/mastery to get 25% off your first month of Ritual. And that's where you can get started on their subscription model. Again, this one's just a little different. It's ritual.com/mastery for 25% off.
And all that being said is, do you think that we can train our spirit?
Train our spirit? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think in a way, when I think of training the spirit a little bit is, for me, it's like the tree is the best metaphor in a way that the tree is not training to become better, right? The tree is just growing and bearing fruit. Mm-hmm. And I think when I think of training the spirit, I'm almost thinking of the yoga idea of Chitta Vritti Nirodha, of silencing the fluctuations of the thought waves of the mind, which is this beautiful phrase again in Sanskrit called Chitta Vritti Nirodha, which is what they say, what yoga is defined as in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, that yoga is this act of fluctuating, chilling or subduing the fluctuations of consciousness or fluctuations of the mind. So in a sense, when you say training the spirit, I think of it as basically silencing the mind for the innate natural tendency to express itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how I think of it as well.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, so what do you do? How long have you been practicing yoga and or meditation and or mindfulness as a training practice?
About not too long, actually, but about, I would say, 3-4 years has been, I've started to delve into the practices in about for the last 3-4 years, yeah.
And then growing up, did you have meditation or mindfulness as part of, a communal system?
No. It was actually, as I said, there was a lot of learning, but not enough reflection and experience on the concepts. Like the foundation of learning was there in terms of people talked about this a lot.
Okay.
Like in some form or the other, everybody talked about karma, it also made sense of the world around us, right? In a way, like in the US, when I live in New York, I can go for days without seeing suffering, right? Because like I'm not being exposed to the Bronx every day in my life. I live in Brooklyn and I'm just like, you know, not being exposed to suffering. In India, you have to, the most uncaring person has to answer why is there, every time you go to school, a legless beggar in your path? Like, even if you're like 6 years old, you have to answer the question on why is this world so unjust and cruel? Mm-hmm. I think in the US, like that kind of contemplation is not very visceral. It does happen, but it's not as immediate and urgent because you don't grow up in that extreme. Even in a pretty idyllic place like ours, you are surrounded by suffering, and it's in a very horrendous form. And so this idea of karma, cause and effect, why does it happen? These questions were dominant in our growing up.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Okay, so what are you most hungry for in life? Like, what is the thing that you're really setting out to understand? I don't even know if I'm asking this right, but yeah, what are you most hungry for?
Right now, I'm not actually very hungry right now. Like, in the sense, I'm very...
I knew you were going to say that.
No, in the sense, like, I'd be very honest if I was, but I'm in a... I guess I'm in a hunger of, like... kind of living in accordance with the purified principles of living, I guess if in its more simplest form, I just want to live up to my own standards of my practice, if you will. I guess I'm most hungry for living this idea of chittavritti nidura, of chilling the thought waves of the mind. And I can see there are small things that happen in my everyday moment, which are wonderful because they happen physically first. Like when I lean forward and talk, or when I'm seeing my steps moving faster, I immediately know that I'm kind of falling from where I want to be, because that means that I'm definitely not present. I'm already thinking of the next moment. I'm rushing towards something. So the physical signs start to happen when I am not living in that life. When I become conscious of my hunger towards something, and then I immediately correct myself a little.
Mm.
Yeah.
What? How do you get in your own way?
How do I get in my own way? Mm-hmm. How do I get in my own way? I don't know. I try not to, I guess. I think like I have a tendency to be very left-brained and logical. I think that's my biggest underpinning. That's where I feel like I get in my own way if I'm becoming extremely rational, left-brained, logical. Which happens to me very much, and then I think that's why I think this 414, when it happens and I start to note that it's happening, I kind of like look forward to those that year in which I'm gonna consciously do not do that like when I'm here, because I'm just, it's my natural tendency to kind of like plan out everything in great detail, and
so what do you think about competition?
Competition, I do, like, I think there's no, like, there's just no competition at all. Like, in the sense, I think truly, I'm not speaking from this elevated place, but I guess the tree is the tree and the river is the river. I keep going back to that same metaphor. I think the innate tendencies are very different among people.
So when in this artificial sport game, or in life, in other outside of sport, when we're in business, right? Like Procter & Gamble is competing with said resources of consumers, for their products. Maybe it's, I think Procter, like Gillette, right? You've got, what's the new kind of razor that, I can't even think of the company, but I think there's a couple of them that are like the Dollar Shave.
Dollar Shave Club, yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so that's competing with one of your products, Gillette. And so, like, how do you think about competition? Because for me, competition is like, it helps sharpen, it helps refine, it provides a context to work together with other people, and honoring the ability to give, and even honoring people across the net or the half court or whatever it is that we're competing with, honoring that they're working diligently as well to see how well they can refine their craft. And so I don't see it as a, I'm going to rip your throat out. I see it as an honor system to keep us sharp, to keep going deeper. And it's artificial, in sport, but in life, there is a primitive life. There is a competition for resources. And, so, Yeah, can I don't know. Can you keep going about that a little bit?
Yeah, I can. Can I digress a little bit, because I think there's an interesting idea which I think you might find interesting in this broader context, which is this whole idea of there was an axial age, which was 10 BC to 0 AD, right? In that 10 BC to 0 AD period, you had the Buddha, the yogis, Jesus Christ, Confucius. So you had all these kind of like Muhammad, all these mystical thinkers sprouted in different parts of the world at the same time, completely disconnected with each other. They didn't know that they were having the same mystical insights into the nature of reality. But there was this 10th century period, which a lot of the reason why that happened, or at least I hypothesize and what I've learned a little bit about why that happened, was that you were at this perfect balance in which civilization had progressed to the extent that there was enough material prosperity that you didn't have to battle for resources all the time. And yet it hadn't progressed to the extent that there was so much distraction that you didn't have the space and time to contemplate it all. So there was not enough technology, and light and electricity and all that stuff didn't exist. So you were in this perfect balance in which you had enough resources to be able to contemplate without being distracted from this act of contemplation. And that led to a very pure mystical insight into the nature of reality in some form, because if you look at their conclusions, they are so remarkably similar, right?
The Eight Path Fold and the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, right? All kind of like that. And then the yogis are talking about the same thing. When you look at the kind of the fountainheads of these religions, they are so surprisingly similar, right? They're all talking about the same complete selflessness, and that suddenly reaching that state where you lose all concept of the I, the individual, you become one with the universe. They're all saying the same thing in different formats, and some have laid out a more clearer path towards how to get that. Some people just had this mystical insight without experiencing it. But so anyway, the reason I digress there is because there was something very magical that happened in that time that I wish happens in some other century in human existence, where people don't think that where they have enough time to contemplate, because they either believe or they have experienced a level of resources where they think that they have enough resources that they don't have to keep battling for more. And on the other hand, they're not so distracted by wanting to become and all that stuff that they have enough time for a mystical contemplation. So I guess to kind of answer your question in a very long-winded way, I try to think of my life being a little bit trying to make sure that I have this space in which I'm not constantly battling for resources and becoming better and have this space for contemplation, because I think that's kind of the purpose almost of existence. And now to answer your question in a more practical way, for me, the most jarring component of my work is when we start to talk about what this competition is doing and why we should beat them and why what we should do. Those are actually jarring. Those are my only disconnected moments with my work, because I feel like it's an unnecessary kind of discussion which has no, maybe the only bearing is to learn to become better, but that you can do in a much more, I guess, in a more silent way, in which you just kind of learn and become better, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, cool. All right. Word is precious.
Sorry, it went to a very mystical, but I think it was that perspective was kind of important, because a very important part of my life to think about why that happened,
Yes. It you have this blend between left logic and intuitive mystic. That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Where does pressure come from?
Where does pressure come from is completely comes from extrinsic motivations. Whenever I think your motivations get extrinsic, I think pressure starts to rise.
How do you fill in this thought? Love.
Selflessness.
Relationships.
Selflessness again in some form, yeah. The best relationships have a complete dissolution of your ego or your sense of self.
Success is...
Success is the dharma. Success is living your dharma.
It all comes down to
living your dharma in some form or the other, to purify your life to the extent that your purest natural tendencies express themselves.
And then my vision.
My vision is to live in this state of flow for as long as I can, like, you know, to, to create from a place of flow or from a place of not like of complete becoming a medium for my work to express itself.
Beautiful. And how long do you, what does your mindfulness practice look like on a daily basis?
Definitely in the night, I no matter what time I sleep, I will meditate before I go to sleep for very rational reasons, because I think I have a completely dreamless sleep, which is very, very restful and deep. So like my so I always do that for 15, 20, 25 minutes, whatever I happens. Morning has become very stolen moments now because of two toddlers, you know, 18 months old, 1 month old. You're very like it's very variable. The sleep is very variable. So I just steal moments in the morning when I can.
So as an executive who understands marketing and influence of ideas amongst other people and being able to do that with a global footprint, what do you hope the next generation gets right, knowing the influence of marketing that is had on people?
Yeah, great question. I think the one thing I hope the next generation gets a little better now is I think there's just like too much of a pendulum shift to everybody's talking about entrepreneurship, build your own dream or you'll build someone else's dream. Like there's a lot of messages in culture now about it almost makes the person feel that success means starting your own thing. And I think there is like, I think it's completely... Like, I don't think that's the right thought at all, I think. So I hope the next generation doesn't believe these messages of, I think the next generation should believe that there are many alternate paths. Like, I think, like, in my path, I would never want to become an entrepreneur. And I feel it's a very, like, it's just still a path which is allowing me to express a lot. Like, I don't think the only way to express all dimensions of yourself is to create or to become an entrepreneur, because I don't think people understand that I think people don't understand the complexity of becoming an entrepreneur. Doesn't mean like you are just creating. I think you're creating and creating an infrastructure around creation. And if your joy is in pure creation, there are many ways to accomplish that.
Well said. And my experience on entrepreneurship and founding is that there's a lot of conversation about runway of money and, you know, do you have enough time and resources to be able to do the thing you want to do? And so it's exactly sometimes opposite of creating enough space to be able to create.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you have to know that, like, if we all have a desire to create, and let's not mistake that desire to become an entrepreneur. I think they're two different things almost.
Beautiful. So in your words, how do you articulate or define mastery?
I was thinking about this question a lot. And I think for me, mastery is a little bit of infinite, because in any stream, right, be it writing, like if I think of any stream that I'm doing work in, there is an infinite amount of knowledge and wisdom that I can get. So truly, I think there is no set point of mastery, almost as I feel like mastery comes when I'm in a complete, I'm a vessel for my work, right? Where I'm in a complete state of I become my work. Like my work becomes me. And so this kind of state of selflessness is mastery. Or complete consumption in your work, in which you become just a medium for the work to express itself, is mastery.
Okay. Where can we find more about what you're up to? And
My website is very, like, it's got like a lot of content on publishing, marketing, media, or meditation. Like, it's very I try to keep the content very high quality, because again, I'm not trying to become anything through the content. Like, I'm not trying to become a meditation teacher or a writing expert. I'm sharing my best journey of what has led me to like achieve some success in writing and like some success in my spiritual practice, in that way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So Karan Bajaj, KaranBajaj.com.
Correct. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And then tell us about the new book.
The new book is called The Yoga of Max's Discontent. My first novel came out in 2008, the second one in 2010. This has taken 5 and 6 years to come out. So it's been a very... a very monumental effort from my end. Like, again, not in an objective way because that's for people to judge, but in a personal way, it's taken, I was trying to do a lot of, like, I was trying to do something which was very personal to me with this book. I was trying to write a journey of tremendous personal transformation, which was a crackling page-turning thriller. And I wanted to kind of combine these two opposing forces because I think I'd seen all journeys of transformation to become a little bit pedantic in which the author has a message that they're trying to communicate through the book. I wanted to have no sense of authorship at all. I wanted the reader to completely dissolve themselves in the character and like just become completely immersed in the character's journey. So I was trying to write a very fast-paced, thrilling journey in which there was no author at all, and yet the reader kind of merges into the character and becomes completely transformed as a result. So I think that whole idea kind of took a while to come in shape. So in a short form, it's about a banker who becomes a yogi in the Himalayas. At its surface, it's a very page-turning adventure through very hidden parts of India, like surreal night ashrams and hidden caves and mountaintops that you like a hikes through mountaintops and stuff. So it's a very page-turning adventure. And at its most visceral level, it's a complete dissolution of the self that happens to the character. So yeah, so I think, you know, I'm kind of happy that I've been able to finally get to a level that I was happy with.
Yeah, so good.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Must feel wonderful to be able to have the thought from inception and to put your head down and be able to create from something that's meaningful. So congratulations, and you know, congratulations on the great success you've had from your former books and selling over multiple hundred thousands copies is a tremendous, you know, gift to the world. So I've just appreciated this conversation, and I appreciated the insight that you have, and you know, you ground us in humility and dharma, and you ground us in a way to pursue the inner experience. So thank you.
No, thank you, Michael. This is a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yeah, beautiful. And so do you also have some social media we can find you on?
Yes, I'm on Author Karan Bajaj on Facebook and Real Karan Bajaj on Instagram and Twitter.
Yeah. That's really funny, the real.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. I'll put that in the show notes so people can find you. Yeah. And thank you for all of us for you know, staying connected to the journeys that matter to us most. And thank you for listening to this conversation. You can find us at iTunes for Finding Mastery. And you can also find me at social media at Michael Gervais and then facebook.com/Finding Mastery. Okay, bud, really appreciate this conversation. And I look forward to following what you're doing, and hopefully you can come back soon.
Yeah, thank you so much, Michael.
Okay, all the best.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you so much for diving into another episode of Finding Mastery with us. Our team loves creating this podcast and sharing these conversations with you. We really appreciate you being part of this community. And if you're enjoying the show, the easiest no-cost way to support is to hit the subscribe or follow button wherever you're listening. Also, if you haven't already, please consider dropping us a review on Apple or Spotify. We are incredibly grateful for the support and feedback. If you're looking for even more insights, we have a newsletter we send out every Wednesday. Punch over to findingmastery.com/newsletter to sign up. This show wouldn't be possible without our sponsors, and we take our recommendations seriously. And the team is very thoughtful about making sure we love and endorse every product you hear on the show. If you want to check out any of our sponsor offers you heard about in this episode, you can find those deals at findingmastery.com/sponsors. And remember, no one does it alone. The door here at Finding Mastery is always open to those looking to explore the edges and the reaches of their potential so that they can help others do the same. So join our community, share your favorite episode with a friend, and let us know how we can continue to show up for you. Lastly, as a quick reminder, information in this podcast and from any material on the Finding Mastery website and social channels is for information purposes only. If you're looking for meaningful support, which we all need, one of the best things you can do is to talk to a licensed professional. So seek assistance from your healthcare providers. Again, a sincere thank you for listening. Until next episode, be well. Think well and keep exploring.